Good morning. Survived the rain again this morning. For those of you who are not from here, who've just moved here, you'll just look forward to mornings like this when August comes rolling around, and we'll not find any. So enjoy it. There are a great many controversial opportunities and challenges that face our world, that face our nation, that face our church, our community, that really lie before us as people. And there are really two types of people in the world. Those who are noble. And when they look at an opportunity, they ask the question, what's best for everyone? You know, when it comes to the world in which we live, is it best to spend money and human life to create democracy in places in the world where violence exists? It's a global issue. What about saving Social Security? A national issue. What about a school bond election? Or a church planning movement in Austin? The noble person will take a step back and ask the question, what's best for everyone? But there's a second type of person, and that's the normal person. The normal person always starts with the question, what's best for me? When it comes to these big issues, how will they affect me and mine? Will it make my life better, easier? Will it make my financial situation stronger? We call this a personal agenda. And you know what? The world is filled with normal people. Hill Country Bible Church is filled with normal people. And normal people run everything through the grid of how is this going to impact me and what's best for me. Well, what we see is that when we come to our study in Nehemiah, the second major challenge that Nehemiah faces in the building of the wall comes down to the issue of our goal versus my gain. Our goal as a group versus my gain as an individual. And in Nehemiah chapter 5, Nehemiah runs into the second major challenge that leaders face when they're trying to move a group of people to accomplish a great goal. We looked at the first challenge last week. Remember the first challenge? It's discouragement. And it's the greatest challenge. Because no matter what's going on, if people who are working on a project, who've banded together to move forward toward a goal, if they have a heart to work, a heart to push forward, a heart to complete, they will be successful regardless of the obstacles. But if they get discouraged, if they reach a point where they, in their heart of hearts, begin to feel like, is it worth it? Can we do it? Is this the right thing? And they begin to lose focus and discouragement. If they lose encouragement, that's the greatest challenge to any project. And that's why Nehemiah had such harsh words for the critic. Remember last week? The critical person that views it as their lot in life to try to find flaws with every movement or every project. That person is a dangerous person. This week we move to the second major issue, not quite as important as the first one, but it's still important. And that is the issue of personal agendas. You can never create a team. You can never do a group project. You can never accomplish a lot together if everybody in the group is more important, more focused on their personal agendas than they are their group agendas. So we're going to talk about leading through the agenda crisis today. As we look at chapter 5 of Nehemiah, we see this agenda crisis in the first 13 verses. Let's look at them together. In chapter 5, starting in verse 1, it says, "Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, 'We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain.' Others were saying, 'We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine.' Still others were saying, 'We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, "In this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied." At this the whole assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Now, in this section, we run into a major problem. Keep in mind, the wall has been built to the halfway point. The enemies who began to tell them that we're going to come and fight against you, creating a lot of discouragement, that mouth had been silenced for the moment. The people are going back to work. But in the process of going back to work, there is such an economic issue that's taking place that the workmen begin to realize that in the midst of this economic issue, they may face total and complete financial ruin by the time the wall is finished. And so there's a great outcry. And the cause of this problem, which becomes a problem of personal agendas, literally comes about because of two major reasons. The first one is the circumstantial problem. It's the circumstantial problem. If you'll notice in verse 3, there's a famine. And so there's a scarcity of resources anyway. For the small farmer who's growing a crop, if his crop is cut significantly because of the famine, that makes it hard for them economically. The second circumstantial reason that takes place here is the king's taxation. Artaxerxes, the Persian king, is taxing the property at a pretty high rate. In fact, in verse 4, it tells us that they had to borrow money to pay the king's tax. And so you have two incredibly common problems taking place in this midst of this project. They've got a bad economy, the famine, and they've got high taxation, big government. With those two things going on, people are struggling personally. But beyond that, you see some individual problems. First of all, you see the poor people, or the average people, and the situation that they're facing. Notice what happens here. First of all, we notice the large families are struggling. Verse 2, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." So you got people that literally just don't have enough food to feed their families and their clans. They've come into the city to do the work, which makes it even harder because they're spending their day working on the wall and not trying to generate income, so it's becoming increasingly harder to feed their families. In addition to that, we have problems with landowners that are losing their property. Others were saying in verse 3, "We are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine." And so they're having to take their source of income and even the home that they're living in, and they're having to put it up as security in order to get grain just to feed themselves. And then you have the group that are paying taxes. And look at what they say. In verse 5, it says, "Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." And part of the reason why that was happening is because of the interest rates. You'll notice in verse 11 it says that they're paying a hundredth part on the money, grain, new wine, and oil. That's probably per month, based on the best studies of this. So the interest rate's about 12%. And so when you're having to borrow against your property, against your businesses to simply feed your family, how in the world would you ever be able to pay back those loans at 12%? So what happens? You go down to what you have left, your children. And you say, how in the world could anybody put up their kids as collateral? Well, in some cases, it was put up your kids as collateral for a loan and feed them, or not put them up as collateral for a loan and not have any food at all. People will do extreme things when it comes to not being able to actually put food in their children's mouths. Pretty severe situation that they're facing. What are they going to do about it? They're in a bad spot. Their agenda is, we can't work anymore until we can create some stability here financially. If we can't feed our families, if we're losing the family farm, if we're having to sell our kids into slavery, I mean, what are we going to do? We can't keep working. The project must stop. Our agenda is personal security. On the other hand, the rich are getting richer. So you got the poor and what's happening to them, but the rich are getting richer. Notice what the rich are doing. The rich have the financial resources. And so what are they doing? They're loaning those at a good interest rate. And you can see what they're thinking. Like, we got to have food to feed our kids if we're going to give our grain to other people. I mean, shouldn't we get something for that? I mean, it only makes sense. It's our grain. And in addition to that, if we're loaning the money and we're loaning the grain and we're taking a risk on that, should we not be getting something in it back, charging interest? I mean, that's just good business sense. We ought to get something back for that. What about taking their farms? Well, you know, we don't know what the future holds. We have our children to think of and the generation to come and the generation to come after that. I mean, just acquiring more land, that's simply setting aside for retirement and for the future stability of our kids. And so when the rich looked at their situation and what they were doing good business practices. They were securing for the future. From their standpoint, the agenda of personal gain, this is a great time for us to make money, great business climate. Their idea is, this is really working for us. The poor people are saying, this isn't working for us at all. And the whole time, the project is not moving forward. Now, if we take a step back, what's God's agenda right here? God's agenda is that His glory would be established again in the city of Jerusalem. What's Nehemiah's agenda? Nehemiah's agenda is that God's glory would be established in the city of Jerusalem by constructing the fortifications around the city, building the wall. But that's not going to happen because the poor people can't feed their families. The rich people are more interested in the security that they can gain in the midst of all this. And the bottom line is that everybody's got an agenda that's not going to move forward. And so in just a moment, we're going to look at the godly solution to this agenda. But for those of you who lead, you got people who are following you, I want to point out just kind of as a side, something that you need to be aware of. You should already know this, but I think at times as leaders, we think that we've got this all solved. Here's the little aside. No matter what you do, people always talk. I want you to notice in chapter 4, the discouragement sets in when people begin to talk. You notice in verses 10 through 12, it says a group talked, and then another group talked, and then another group talked. In other words, there's this little underlying communication that's taking place, and that's when discouragement sets in. You'll notice this passage, Nehemiah again points out three groups of people. Some were saying, others were saying, others were saying. People begin to talk. And oftentimes, projects or goals do not move forward because leaders think that if you simply get up from the front, pass an edict, here's where we're going to go, sell everybody on an initial idea, that everything will move forward smoothly. But you know what? Every single person lives day by day in their world, and everything that they do affects them. And people will always get together to compare notes. Hey, as we work through this together, how's it going? So if you're managing a group at work, if you think that the people in your group don't kind of get together and compare notes about how they feel about what's going on, or in your ministry, you don't think people get together and talk about how they feel, or in your home, you don't think everybody's talking about how they feel, if you fail to recognize that people are going to get together and compare notes, you're going to miss out on the heartbeat of where people are. It's one of the things that we constantly do here at Hill Country Bible Church is try to gather feedback about what people are thinking and feeling. Because you can't address real needs unless you know. And it doesn't matter what gets said in public. It's what people are feeling personally that will really impact their motivation and their ability to move forward. And so people are all talking, and here's what they're saying. So what in the world do you do when a project grinds to a halt because of personal agendas? Well, look at the godly solution produced here by Nehemiah. His response is just so good. Look carefully at what he does. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I just love that. Don't you love that? He wasn't contemplative of the situation. He wasn't philosophical about it. He didn't run to the Old Testament and flip open to figure out what the truth was. He just got ticked off. He was burning up. Let me talk to you a little bit about anger, because in our culture today, I think we've got this misunderstanding of the role of anger. Since we are created in the image of God, that means some of the attributes that God has have been passed to us, and one of the attributes of God that we see throughout Scripture is God's anger, God's wrath. God gets mad. And He passed that on to us. Now, what is anger? Anger is an emotion which is generated at the point where we see an injustice. It's a God-given emotion that when something triggers us, we see injustice in the world or injustice in our lives or injustice in a relationship, we feel anger. That's the normal emotion. In the same way that when something great happens, you feel joy. You say, well, how do you feel joy? Well, I can't explain it. It just happens. Something funny, you laugh. Well, now, have you ever sat and tried to take that apart and figure out, now, why do you laugh? You just do. Something hurts you deeply, you cry. You get sad. That's an emotion. When you see injustice, the normal response is anger. That's normal. That's what God did. That's how He wired you. But Paul makes it very clear in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, in your anger, normal, legitimate human emotion, in your anger, do not sin. In other words, when you're in the midst of that particular emotion, it's real easy to fly off the handle and do something wrong, to sin. The positive part of anger is that most of the time, if we did not get angry, we would not respond to injustice. Now, let's face it, with your kids, you know, Billy, we paid a lot of money to put this particular color carpet in this room. Not that I particularly like it, but, you know, she thinks it's beautiful. It's there. Do not bring your Coke in here. Drink it in the kitchen. Now, if when Billy brings his Coke in there and spills it on the floor, there wasn't this emotion of, hey, you know what? I told you not to do this. You did it anyway. That's unjust. It's wrong. I'm angry. If there wasn't that emotion, you would never deal with it. You'd have big, huge stains on the carpet, right? Now, that's a minor example. Who would ever care about the big social issues in our world if there wasn't a sense of injustice and anger in response to that? Anger moves us to action. The Bible just warns us to make sure that it's the right action. Now, how do you move from anger to action? Well, there's a step in between that Nehemiah does. It's just absolutely perfect. What we see is he starts off with anger, and then he moves to verse 7. It says, I pondered them in my mind. Anger first, and then pondering second. The word ponder there literally means he consulted with himself. In other words, he sat down, and in his mind he says, I'm seeing what's taking place out here. That makes me really angry that the rich are benefiting from this situation, that progress has stopped because the poor are getting taken advantage of here, that things are wrong, that are messing with what God has called us to do. I'm really angry about that. Let me think about it. Let me consult with myself. Let me ponder it. Let me come up with something reasonable in response to this emotion of anger. So his motivation comes from the anger, but his response comes from reason. He thinks it through. And then the third step in the process is that he goes out, and the passage says that he accused the nobles and officials and told them, you are exacting usury from your countrymen. And then he calls a large meeting to deal with it. His third step in the process is he goes out and he presents a case. The word accused there is literally means to bring charges against. He brought a formal complaint or formal charges against them. And really there are five things, that he brought before them to bring to their attention. The first is he showed them how legally what they were doing was wrong. He pointed it out from a legal standpoint. In Exodus chapter 22, verse 25, in the law, it says that you cannot charge interest on money that you loan to somebody who is poor. In other words, if you're loaning for commercial interest, someone's speculating, or they're trying to expand their business, that's a different deal. But when you come to someone who doesn't have the food to feed their family and you loan them money, or they don't have the grain to plant their field, and you're lending them seed crop because they can't move forward without that, and then you tack an interest rates onto that, the Old Testament called that usury. And an Israelite was not supposed to do that to someone else. Secondly, he points out to them the relationship that they have. In verse 8, he says, the people that you're mistreating, these are your brothers. How could you do this to your own kin? Third, he brings before them the issue of their worship. He brings them before them the issue of their worship. In verse 9, he says, so I continued, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God? And don't you fear God when you're putting your agenda so far forward that it puts at risk the people that are your brothers? And then he brings before them the fourth thing, is their reputation. Their reputation. He goes on in that verse, to avoid the reproach of the Gentile enemies. The Gentile enemies treat their own people better than this. Don't you care about your reputation? And finally, he points out to them his personal example. He tells them, he says in verse 10, I and my brothers and my men are also lending money and grain to these people. In other words, we're not just letting people starve. We're loaning them the grain, but we're not charging them interest. We'll let them pay us back when they have the ability to do so. So he says, I'm not taking advantage of people. You shouldn't be taking advantage of people either. So he moves from the emotion of anger to thinking through what he's going to say, to getting with them, accusing them and challenging them. And the text says that they don't respond because there's nothing that they can say. Now, the next thing that he does is really significant. The next thing he does is he gives them a chance to make it right without making them villains. Notice what he does. Verse 13, he simply just gives them a chance to fix the problem. Without making them villains. What would he have done if he would have vilified that group of people? If he would have vilified the rich, he would have alienated them from the rest. And what he does is, rather than alienating them, he just simply gives them a chance to make it right. It's one of the most important things that you can do as a leader. If you see someone doing something wrong, just correct it, point it out to them, and give them a chance to fix it. And if they fix the problem, that's great. But in order to rebuild trust, he does one more thing, and that is he calls for a commitment, and he does it in public. This is very interesting. "We will give it back," they said in verse 12. "We will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priest and made the nobles officials take an oath to do what they had promised. He brought them in public and they made an oath. They made a promise in front of the priests to do what they committed to do. You know, it's one of the things that from time to time people will look at what's taught in Ecclesiastes about the danger of making oaths or making promises that you're not intending to fulfill and the danger of that. But the Bible still encourages us to make commitments and make promises and verify them in a public way. In fact, in Psalm 77, it tells us to make our vows to the Lord and to keep those vows. You know, somebody challenged me one time when we were going through the great investment, and then later through, earlier through the Beyond the Open Door about signing a pledge card. Why would we sign a pledge card? Isn't that wrong to do? No, that's biblical. We see that all the time. You make a promise and you commit to it in a public way, and that ensures that you really understand that before God, when I promise to do something, I'm going to follow through on doing that. And the result of that is the personal agendas are all set aside and the people come back together and they begin to work on the project. Now, that sounds really easy. But there's something going on behind the scenes that gives Nehemiah the platform to be able to call for this kind of commitment. This next section of Scripture really lays the groundwork for your ability to influence other people. Whether it's influencing people in your home, whether it's influencing people in your ministry, in your place of business, if you work for the government, if you're a teacher, in whatever setting you find yourself, the ability to influence people has a lot more to do with who you are and what you're like than it does what you say. Look at what happens with Nehemiah here. This is an incredible, incredible thing. We see that Nehemiah is now leading by doing the unexpected. He's leading by doing the unexpected. And in the unexpected he does, he has incredible success. In verse 14, we learn something about Nehemiah. It says, "Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah." We're almost halfway through the book, and we now, just now, find out that this incredible leader also has an official title. He is the governor. Up till this point, all of the leadership that we've seen in the book has come completely out of his personal prayer life, his vision, his challenge, his skill as a leader. We don't even have any reference that when he showed up in the land, he said, "Hey guys, I'm the governor. Here's what we're going to do. I'm the official representative of the king. Here's what we're going to do." That's not even mentioned until this point. Obviously, as far as Nehemiah is concerned, his title and his position is not the platform from which he leads. And let me make that very clear. People ultimately will not follow a platform. People ultimately will not follow a title. People ultimately will not follow a position. What people follow is a person of character and integrity. And we see that in Nehemiah's example here. Nehemiah does not do what people expect of leaders. Now, what is it that people expect leaders to do? The first thing that people expect leaders to do is to demand special treatment. To demand special treatment. Notice what he says. He says in verse 14, the second half, he says, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allocated to governors. We didn't take the food that would normally be the food given to governors that would be allotted and expected for people in the community to provide. Usually the governor would be entertaining large numbers of officials. In fact, he would be responsible. They'd be kind of on his payroll. And so he would tax the people and he would feed all of the people in the government offices. He said, we didn't do that. We didn't take that. Most of us expect that leaders expect special treatment. I remember one day I got invited to speak at a church. And so I drove to the speaking engagement, and as I was leaving with the pastor, the thing was over, and I was walking out the door with the pastor, and right there in the first spot, right next to his spot, you know, pastor spot, right by the door, right next to his spot, was this beautiful black Lexus. And he said, is that your car? I said, no, you see that dirty Honda at the back corner of the parking lot? That's my car. But in his mind, like, you're the pastor of a big church? Don't you get special treatment? Don't you have your parking place and your nice car? People expect that leaders expect to be treated special. They expect preferential treatment. Just think about the CEO of your company. That's normal. Second thing that people expect from leaders is that leaders are free with your money. Tax and spend. That's what leaders do, right? Take your money and use it. Notice what he says. He goes on to say in verse 15, but the early governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to the food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. That's what people are used to. That those who are leading will take your money and spend it. That's what they do. That's normal. The perks flow up in our culture. The third thing that people expect from leaders, it's just an expected normal thing, is that leaders are going to use every advantage to develop their own personal security. Leaders are going to use every advantage to make sure that they develop their own personal security. Notice what he says in the last part of this paragraph. He says, instead, I devoted myself to the work on the wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Now here he is, cupbearer to the king in Susa, right? He travels to become the governor of Judah. All of the famine and the economic hardship on the people would have given him and his team the opportunity to create large masses of land that belonged to them so that he would have a secure foothold in the land. And you know what he says? We didn't do that. We didn't acquire any land. And one of the great scourges on American business, and I think we're reaping the consequences of this over the past few years with all of the incredible arrogance that had brought down a number of companies that affected our economy. Explain to me how a CEO can be leading a company that's losing money and laying people off and still pay themselves millions and millions and millions of dollars. How do you do that? If you're the leader and you're losing people, laying people off, the company's not making money, who's the most responsible? Shouldn't it be you? I mean, if somebody's going to forego their bonus this year, who should it be? The person responsible, right? But that's not what we expect, because that's not what we're used to. That's not what we see. We expect that the people at the top are going to take care of their own personal security first. Nehemiah doesn't do any of that. In fact, Nehemiah does the unexpected. And here's where we learn an awful lot about this guy. People follow leaders that do two things. Number one, give for people and for vision. They give their life for the people they're serving and the vision that they're trying to accomplish. Notice in verse 17, he says, "Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor because the demands were heavy on these people. I didn't ask for anything more than what we absolutely had to have because the people were working hard and laboring under heavy demands." He was tuned into the needs of the people, and he was sensitive to what they needed over what he could get out of them. Secondly, he was also connected to the vision, and he worked at the vision. Notice what it says, jumping back up to the latter half of verse 16, he says, "All my men," excuse me, first part, he said, "instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall." Nehemiah put his time and energy into the project, and he worked on it. And it goes on to say that his men worked on it too. He was focused on two things: the people that are helping and what their needs are, and the project that we're working on, and that's what he spent his time doing. One of the things that we noticed around here when we started interviewing to hire pastors for our various staff positions was how many people in ministry just have a really poor work ethic. Just a really poor work ethic. You know, they just want to come and put in a few hours here and there, prepare to teach a class, and go home. That's not how our staff operates. We work hard. We put in time. We put in effort and energy. Because the vision is worth it. And Nehemiah, when you looked at his life, you could see that he cared about the people and he cared about the work. And that was most important to him. Finally, the last thing, people follow leaders that get... they get their sense of security and value from God, not from gain. Notice what it says in verse 19. He says, "Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people." Now, I don't know about you, but when he prays this prayer, I see a Nehemiah sitting out at night under the stars. And he's had to put up with making the rich mad, listening to the poor people who were struggling and hearing all their complaints, confronting the people who are trying to attack him, defaming his character, and he's building a wall in a city where he doesn't own property, in a place where he's not getting wealthy from. He's doing the work for other people. And you see his true motivation when he's sitting out there at night and he's looking over all of this and he's probably just cataloged all of the hassle in his life. And then he turns to his true focus. He says, "Remember me, God. Remember me. Because that's where I'm going to get my reward from you." And when he prays that prayer, he's saying, "God, I remember you. You remember me. This is about leading in a way that's pleasing to you and looking to you for my reward." And at the end of the day, dads, at the end of the day, it's not how your spouse feels about you. It's not how your kids feel about you. At the end of the day, employee, it's not what all the people at work think. Teachers, it's not just pleasing your students, making the administration happy. Sunday school teachers, at the end of the day, remember me, O God, because I'm here and I'm doing this for you. Because the project is for your glory. My life is for your glory. And that's why I'm here. And a leader that leads from that platform has the ability to move people to do great and incredible things for God, because it's all for His glory that we do what we do. Let's bow our heads and pray. Father in heaven, we just want to thank you that you have called us to serve in ministries and in lives that really make an impact. Father, protect us from the personal agendas that would pull us away, because our desire is that your great and marvelous, your glorious works be done in our lives and in this world for your honor and glory. We pray this.